Hello, and welcome to The Real, the podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I'm your host, Mark Olson. On today's episode, Celine Sciamma, writer and director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
I didn't craft the film thinking it would be a manifesto for the film I gaze, but I kind of like the fact it's been looked at that way. Sometimes when people want to reduce our work, and when I say our, I think about women directors, they kind of say, oh, there's a message, or it's political. Like, in the end, we would do cinema to actually embody ideas. You know, that it wouldn't be for the sake of art, but for some kind of activism. I am an activist, and I am an activist as a citizen. I am an activist. When I make a film, I'm also an activist for cinema. And politics are at the root of the film. And you turn them into art. But then there's politics in the end also, in the way people look at the film. And I find that quite beautiful, I must say. I am also totally aware that this is a great opportunity for art, fiction, a great opportunity for audience to have new emotional rides, new perspective on cinema. And also, I hope, for writers and directors feeling legitimate to tell their stories.
That's coming up. But first, I'm here with my colleagues to do a quick recap of the Oscars and finally top off this award season. So I'm joined by my colleagues here, Justin Chang, Amy Kaufman, and Glenn Whip. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
And now, in the day or two after Sunday night, we're recording this kind of midweek, there were messages flying around amongst the sort of LA Times movie writers, more or less along the lines of, did that happen? Did Parasite win? Hey, Parasite won Best Picture. It still is something that I think is like sinking in for a lot of people, like just what it means that the movie won 4 prizes. Bong Joon-ho personally won 3 prizes. Glenn, give us some sense of what does this mean? I mean, do you sense that this is some kind of a shift from the Academy?
It means my faith in humanity has been restored, that it's a great new day. The sun is shining. Gives me hope for the election coming up later this year.
Oh, wow.
Maybe,
as someone said on Twitter, if we can go from Green Book to Parasite, we can go from Trump to Warren. So I agree.
If we went Moonlight, Shape of Water, Green Book, Parasite, what's going to happen
next year?
It
means you're guaranteed a pattern of great winner, so-so winner, terrible winner, great winner. Next year will be a so-so winner. The following will be terrible.
Justin, we were all here at the LA Times offices together on Sunday night when the Oscars were going on. You, I think I can reveal, were extremely excited about the wins for Parasite. Give me some sense of what those wins meant to you.
Yeah, I'm still ecstatic. I haven't come down from the high of Sunday night. Oscar night is usually a disappointing / demoralizing experience, and it's rare that my favorite movie of the year actually is named Best Picture. It's also rare, it's never happened before, that that movie has been a non-English language film. I just think the fact that we're seeing 92 years of history having been shattered by this moment is absolutely huge. Does this mean that we're going to see a whole rash of subtitled movies finally vying for Best Picture in a way that they never have before? Maybe, maybe not. But it's just so exciting to contemplate that possibility. I really love what A.O. Scott wrote in the New York Times about this when he said that, I'm paraphrasing, what seemed impossible before suddenly looks inevitable in retrospect. And the fact is that, you know, Parasite was this great underdog winner. The fact that it won so decisively, not just Best Picture, but also director and original screenplay. I think Birdman was the last movie to pull off that feat, to win picture, director, and a writing award. It is a stronger movie than I think even those of us who love it gave it credit for. And that is huge. And it's just thrilling. And I just love the idiot discussion that's taking place now about, oh, subtitled movies, I don't want to read the stupid text on the screen. It's like, we do a fair amount of Academy bashing, like, oh gosh, they'll never vote for a subtitled movie. And it's like, and good for them, to their credit, they did. And then you realize that actually, when it comes to like the mainstream public, people who are in the Academy do represent a more intelligent group than the vast majority of people who don't, you know, as a rule, don't go to see non-English language movies. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound in some like, you know, rarefied ivory tower, but my God, people, get some culture in you.
I had a rival awards consultant for a competing, you know, movie ask me last week, well, would you be happy if any other movie besides Parasite won? And I thought about it, because I loved some of the other Best Picture nominees. I think I'll be watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Little Women, The Irishman. I'll be watching these movies for years to come. But no, I would not be as happy if any of those movies had won, because this was so long overdue and such a statement for Parasite to win. It was insane to watch it. I couldn't believe it happened. I still can't.
And now, at least watching the show, you got this sense that every time the movie was winning an award, there were these great outpourings of emotion in the room, and you felt this building momentum for it through the course of the night. Amy, you were there at the Dolby Theater. You were backstage. What was it like to be there? What was the feeling in the room as those awards were being given out?
I mean, I think my friend asked me this. She was at the Vanity Fair dinner, and she said when Parasite won Best Picture, everyone was gasping and totally shocked and, like, really excited. And I don't think people were shocked when it won Best Picture because of the momentum it was building throughout the night. I mean, that's obvious to people like us who understand maybe that the earlier awards are bellwether for Best Picture. But once it had the first two under its belt, I kind of was like, oh, okay, it's going to be Parasite, you know? And, like, it was definitely a ton of excitement, but not surprise, sort of the way that you've had in past years during the Moonlight La La Land fiasco.
Glenn, there's a temptation to maybe, like, overread these wins for Parasite. Do you think this is significant of something happening in the Academy? Is it kind of just the way this year fell out? I mean, from the perspective of this happened a few days ago, what do you think this is kind of saying about where things are at with the contemporary Academy?
I think you can overread into it, because when the nominations came out, we weren't particularly enthused about the way they shook out. So to say that this outcome on Sunday night is reflective of a change might be a bit of a reach. It might be another 92 years before another non-English language movie wins Best Picture. I don't think so. We kept talking during this award season, like, where are all those international members that were being added? Why isn't this kind of being reflective in what we're seeing? And Sunday night, it sure was. And we'll see going forward what kind of movies end up getting nominated and perhaps winning Oscars. I'm hopeful, but I was so pessimistic going into these Oscars that it's hard for me to just erase that with one award show.
But it was such a pure moment that you almost want to. I wrote when I was writing about it, it's like, you know, I wouldn't say all is forgiven. I mean, the Academy has a lot to make up for. But it does make up for a lot. It did sort of rip off, I think, this veneer of cynicism for me. It's like, and this is why people have, and I'm as cynical as anyone when it comes to the Oscars, and so is Glenn, but it's like, we keep watching and we keep caring because what they do actually can change the direction of cinema.
It really can. Like, this is a small thing, but, you know, and I know we live in LA and a lot of people are in close proximity to the entertainment industry, but my two roommates had, we get screeners and they look through, of course, the first ones are kind of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, or the ones with the big movie stars are the ones that you pop in. And the last one they had was Parasite. And I think literally the Friday before Oscars, they were like, we really should watch Parasite. It seems like people are really excited. And they were so glad they did. And I think exactly what you're saying, the stamp of approval that gives the movie makes you feel like, why didn't I give this a chance to begin with over a Brad Pitt film?
Glenn, can you talk a little bit about the acting awards and, like, some of the other awards throughout the night, and the fact that they were so predictable, that ended up being that those four actors won the Golden Globe, the Critics' Choice, the BAFTA, the SAG Award, and then the Oscar.
That's wild.
It is wild, and so they had to write different speeches for all those nights, and it was interesting.
Oh, it's so hard for
them. Well, it is so hard, but I mean, it was interesting, I guess, to watch the tones of the speeches change. And at different events, like Brad Pitt was much more serious at the Oscars. He kind of rose to the occasion. I liked his other speeches a little bit better, actually. They were more entertaining. But once you get up on that stage,
you get a
mosh. Oscar, yeah. Well, and you get just the whole enormity of it. It's still the Oscar just towers over any other award, and you kind of get lost in that moment, I think.
Amy, you were backstage throughout the show. Were there any moments that really stand out to you? I remember you told me that when Joaquin Phoenix came off stage after winning the Best Actor Award, he seemed visibly shaken. He was moved.
Yeah, so our photographer Al Saib is the only photographer who gets to be backstage. And he has this amazing vantage point. His lens is right there when the winners come off. And the stage manager, Gary Natoli, has been doing this for many years. When Joaquin got close to sort of coming backstage and all of those shutterbugs, because a lot of Oscar photographers are there and journalists and stagehands, he was like, let him have a moment, because he was, I guess, crying. And the stage manager was like, you know, let's not put flashbulbs in his face when he's still really emotional. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like, he walked by and he looked down at the Oscar when he finally did come through, and he said to the production person walking by, like, wait, so whose is this? And she was like, it's yours. Because he thought it was just fake, or I don't know what he thought, like, that it was a not one that he should actually keep. But there are some moments where it's like the Oscar and the shape that these people's lives has taken is validated in that moment, and it's hard for them to really comprehend it. I like when it's more emotional like that. And like, Renee Zellweger was shaking and she was like, oh my God, I can't stand up straight, and had her cute little Southern drawl. But it's like, I don't know. There's some people it feels like it hits them more.
Well, I thought the end of Brad Pitt's speech, the way he said, once upon a time in Hollywood, ain't it the truth?
And then stuck his tongue out.
That was just, there was something, it's like that line had been hanging there all season long, and no one had quite grabbed it yet. And yeah, exactly. For him to say that in that moment was just wonderful.
Y'all love an emotional dude, is what I'm gathering from this. Like, the men were moved by the emotional men.
Well, I mean, and speaking of Joaquin Phoenix, too, who I think, you know, gave better speeches on the way to the Oscars than he did the night of, although I liked his speech, complete with the, you know, foray into his deep passion for veganism, and that, I was listening. I was hanging on his every word, even when it, both his and Renee Zellweger's speeches, I think, were drawn out to perhaps an uncomfortable
length. Even as a meat aficionado like
you. Even as a completely bloodthirsty carnivore as myself, but, you know, who is trying to do better and eat less meat. But I think that it's funny what you guys are saying about in the spotlight and the moment hits you. And it's also like, you're already there. You've given all the good speeches to get you there. So you can kind of give a kind of rambling, shaggy, indulgent speech, but which ended very emotionally with his quoting of his brother, River Phoenix's words.
You guys are talking about like the good, impactful moments, but what about all the WTF moments? Eminem randomly coming back for an 18-year anniversary?
That's the thing. I mean, I think with this show in particular, the show was so weirdly shaped. They would have people introducing the people, introducing the awards. If it hadn't ended up with the Parasite narrative, if the people who ultimately won hadn't won, it would have seemed like a weird show. But ultimately, who cares? Like, I completely forgive anything weird about that show because it turned out to be a great show.
Right. If it had ended in a different way, man, this would be a different podcast, wouldn't it?
And so with that, we're going to put the lid on this year's Oscar season. Thanks to the three of you. And I guess we'll be talking about the Oscars again soon enough. And now, it's time for Glenn Whip's Awards Minute.
So yes, award season is over, for a few months at least. And who would have thought, back in the fall when we were talking and wondering if Parasite could become the first South Korean movie to be nominated for international feature, that would not only do that, but it would go on to win Best Picture. Historic season, pretty great season. I think I still haven't run into anyone who's seen Parasite who didn't at least like it a lot. Others just borderline obsessed with it. And so I think the outcome is about as thrilling as we could hope for. A non-English language movie, first time in 92 years of the Oscars winning Best Picture. It's been great sharing these moments with you throughout the awards season. We'll be back in the fall with some more.
Thank you, Glenn. Now I'm joined by Céline Sciamma, writer and director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It's a French historical romantic drama set in 18th century France, and the film is being released by Neon, who also put out our Best Picture winner, Parasite. And actually, it's funny, Sciamma was sort of rolling with the Neon crew on Oscars night, and so she was in a lot of photos with them. She was seen at their Neon party and after party. And unfortunately, we recorded our interview before the Academy Awards, so we didn't get a chance to ask her what it was like to be there for that. But she really is one of those sort of most exciting cinema minds, I think, to emerge from France in the last few years. And this is a very exciting conversation. Céline, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And now the film, it won the screenplay prize at Cannes, where it premiered last year, and since then it's gone on to be nominated for a Golden Globe, a Spirit Award, a BAFTA Award, multiple nominations with the French Lumiere Awards. Can you describe the movie to me? Like, how do you tell people what the story of the movie is?
Well, quite simply, I like to pitch it as a movie dedicated to love, how love is born, and also the memory of a love story. It's a love dialogue through time and space. And it's also a love dialogue that is a creative dialogue.
One of the things I find so remarkable about the movie is that it is both this simple, contained love story about these two women falling in love over a very small period of time. And yet at the same time, the movie is about women's place in society, the role of art, who gets to depict certain stories. Was it a challenge for you in writing the movie to sort of have it working on both those levels as like this very intimate story and also having these really big topics in there too?
Yeah, it was a real challenge. And that's why it took me so long to actually write it. I dreamt about it a lot. And it took me a long time buffering the film because it has many levels and there's a lot of layers. But that kind of challenge, I see it as a strong opportunity. I really see it as harvesting simple ideas to the max, being very playful. So you have to be patient to be playful in a way, not giving everything right away. And that implies the writing process, but also the shooting, I must say. You have to stick to your plan, resist the urge to go fast and to believe absolutely in the delay in every scene as a unit. Because the film is 2 hours long, but there's not a lot of scenes. It's 69 scenes, which is not a lot at all. It's about sticking to your plane, believing in delay, believing in the tools of cinema and the pleasure of taking your time.
Now, in the time since the movie premiered last year at Cannes, have your feelings about it changed? Like, are you looking at the movie or thinking about the movie differently now than you were a year ago?
Well, yes, because not about the movie itself. The reception of the film, of course, makes you think. And also, you see, especially because the film has this privilege of being released in a lot of countries, and I've done 14 releases of the film all over Europe, and now here, you feel seen also. You know, the film is about that. It's about how the artist looks at the world, at the character, but it's also how you look at the artist. So you learn a lot from the way people look at the film and look at you.
That's fascinating to me that part of what the movie is itself about is something that's continued on even as you've been kind of going through the release of the movie.
Yeah, that's one of the layers, I must say, and it's part of the experience. And that's something you can't anticipate. So it's a strong emotional journey promoting a portrait. I never get bored. It never gets mechanical because you meet the audience and you see the audience meeting the film. And that's something I find really beautiful.
And now your first three films have now come to be seen as a kind of a trilogy on teenage coming of age. And then there was 5 years from your previous film, Girlhood, now to Portrait. Do you feel like Portrait of a Lady on Fire is something new for you? Did it feel like you were sort of resetting yourself in some way as you were making this movie?
Yeah, definitely. I wanted it that way. The idea that the first three films were kind of a trilogy definitely is an idea that I handed the press to get closure in a way, and also to put myself in that challenging position where I will have to reset, reboot, but also with very simple ideas behind this. I wanted to tell a story with grown-ups. I wanted to work with professional actresses, and also really wanted to talk about love, a love that would be fully lived, whereas in my previous film, there was always a love interest. There was always a strong rise of desire, but it was mostly about discovering yourself. And I wanted that new interaction where it would be about discovering somebody else, discovering the other.
Your previous films have all been so strongly about now, such strong contemporary films. What was it like in making the transition to doing a period film with Portrait? I mean, if nothing else, your other films, you yourself had done the costumes, and that was something you kind of just couldn't do on this film. Mm-hmm. Was that something difficult for you to give up?
Not at all. I really wanted that. And it's not because you collaborate that you give up, actually. You could see the opposite way around. You could say, well, since I'm going to be collaborating, for instance, on this costume design thing, I'm going to learn more about this craft, and maybe I can reach higher level of intervention because you're working hand in hand with somebody who's specialist, and you can have even more accurate ideas and demands. And you know, this I don't have a particular taste for period pieces. I didn't went through this thinking, oh, I'm gonna do a genre film. Really saw it as the same job, because cinema is always a reconstitution. It's either a reconstitution of the contemporary world, and a period piece is about a reconstitution of the past. So it has the same job with a higher level of intervention. And also really with this challenge that because it was set in the past, it would have to be the most contemporary object. Really also relying on the fact that since this story hasn't been told much, it definitely belonged to the present.
And so how did you do that? How did you make this period movie feel so contemporary, feel so alive?
I tried to think of each film as a prototype. My biggest fear is that, and especially with the period piece, you can think, oh, it's going to be more bourgeois, there'll be more money involved and everything, which is true. My film, production-wise, it's only 4 million euros, the average budget of a French film. So I really tried to keep my freedom to be able to not compromise and to be radical. That's also why I think a lot about production when I write, so that I don't get submerged by challenges that are not interesting or that could get in the way of being radical. As I grow as a filmmaker, I think more and more that being radical is being generous.
How do you mean?
Radicality, for instance, is like the cut between two scenes. Yeah, how do you go from one scene to another in a way that is surprising? And it's generous because if it's new, it's generous because you put the audience in a position where they can get surprised. And I think, you know, there can be a lot of surprise in radicality.
I've heard you say that you were sort of inspired by the idea of wanting to sort of like depict desire, to show desire in this movie. When you sit down to write, where do you start with that? Like, how do you take that sort of large and abstract idea and get to something concrete like the story of the movie?
Well, in a very simple way, yeah, I wanted to film desire because I think it's something we rarely do because of that strong convention that we love, of love at first sight. That's the romance convention. Two beautiful people meet and you totally agree with the fact that they're going to love each other. And I wanted to, yeah, to show the rise of desire. So it means thinking about the different steps and not being afraid of taking your time, thinking that delay and frustration are a good tension. For instance, they kiss after, I don't know if I should say that, but they kissed after like an hour and 20 minutes. And this could look weird, but I think it embodies also something we love in our own love stories. Like when you remember a first kiss, you remember what led to that first kiss. And I really wanted to embody with the tools of cinema what it's like to fall in love and to have the audience engaged in that process with their, of course, their mind, but also with their bodies, to go through this experience of falling in love, like when two lovers recollect how it happened. And so it means, yeah, believing a lot in cinema and believing also in the viewer as somebody active and engaged in the film.
I know I don't quite know how to put this. The movie is not explicit, but it is very sexy. There's something, it's as if the movie itself is really super turned on. Mm-hmm. And was that difficult? I mean, it's a tone and a charge that goes through the entire film. And how did you capture that?
I think by being really, really accurate. For instance, chemistry could seem like this magical thing. Chemistry has a lot to do with the casting process, for instance. I mean, not the casting process, but the casting itself. Two actresses that we pick together in the frame, something happens. I'm not about accident or magic. I think it's about being really accurate about the choreography within the frame. How does somebody walks towards somebody else? It's about how many steps it's going to take. And I'm all about that. I could tell Noémie Merlant when she would have to walk toward the Delanel, you're going to do it in 5 or you're going to do it in 6. And if it's 6, it seems like balanced. If it's 5, it seems fragile. A lot of my answers are about rhythm, that is to say melody. It's believing in the sensuality. So that is something you craft. And that is something you craft all the way. For instance, the breathing, the fact that you breathe out or breathe in, has a very, very different effect on the viewer. So it's about saying, yeah, to the actress at the right moment, breathe out or open your mouth. And so relying, believing in strong detail and creating this tension around faces, because that's cinema. It's the appetite and the urge to see faces as landscapes and interaction as a dance.
You bring up the casting of the film, and Adèle Haenel is someone you've worked with before. Naomi Merlant is new to you as an actress. What were you looking for when you were trying to cast those two roles?
I was looking for a strong equality. That's something I've been looking for throughout the film since writing, trying to break the narrative of conflict that we are so used to, trying to break the idea that conflict and eroticism are linked. The fact that it's two women falling in love already departs from gender domination. But also in the writing, I also decided that there would be no intellectual domination. And it's an artist and a model, so there's always some kind of intellectual domination here. And also that we wouldn't be playing with social hierarchy, even though it exists. Regarding, for instance, the servant, the maid character, she's a maid, but we're not embodying the social class. When she's in the frame, she's a subject. She has a goal. She has a desire. She has something to say.
Well, I know you didn't rehearse with the actresses before shooting. And so in some ways, you didn't really know what they were going to be like together on screen until you had started shooting. What was it like to not know what was going to happen between these two women?
It was something we wanted. I really wanted them to meet on the set. And even I would meet, for instance, Noémie Merlant on the set. And as it's a love story, it's about two people meeting. It felt right. This tension of the unknown seems totally falling in love tension. What's going to happen? And, you know, the set dynamic relied a lot on this idea that the film was also very metaphorical, as we are in the workshop of the painter who is trying to do this portrait, and we were trying to do this portrait in our own workshop. That was the same. It was very joyful to play with this mirroring situation. Very fun, I must say. And I think it's really important to make it fun. I like to work in that kind of mood.
Is it important for you as a filmmaker that you feel like there's a sense of discovery for you in making the movie, that you're not going in there just executing exactly what you know you want, but that you're sort of discovering something, finding something yourself in the process of making the movie?
Yes, of course. I'm being pretty accurate when I write about the scenes, which means by that I mean where they start and where they end. And this quite stays in the editing room, I must say. Most of the cuts, they are written. But within those units, each day before shooting, I was questioning my storyboarding and coming each day with new ideas. Some of the shots were written and stayed like that. But some of the shots really changed from one day to another, because go deep and deep into the shooting process, your grammar is, you know, you build the language of the film and you become more and more accurate. And that means also more and more brave to try new things. So, for instance, there were more and more long takes as the days went by, especially because as I knew that I was going to be in a shot, reverse shot dynamic a lot because of the model and painter situation. I was looking for contrast in the scenes where they were not in that position. I mean, in my previous film, I did very, very few shot, reverse shots. And I was engaged in the process of writing the film. I realized, okay, this has to be a film about shot, reverse shot, for instance. But for all the scenes that weren't in the workshop, I was more free to invent another type of rhythm, choreography, and melody.
The idea of the female gaze is something that people have talked about a lot as they've been discussing the movie. Mm-hmm. And the two women in the movie do spend a lot of time looking at each other and even talking about looking at each other. Yeah. For you, what was it that you liked about taking this thematic idea and making it something explicit in the movie itself?
I didn't craft the film thinking it would be a manifesto for the film on gaze. But I totally like the fact that it's been looked at that way. You know, politics, sometimes when people want to reduce our work, and when I say our, I think about women directors, they kind of say, oh, there's a message, or it's political. Like, in the end, we would do cinema to actually embody ideas, you know, that it wouldn't be for the sake of art, but for some kind of activism. I am an activist, and I am an activist as a citizen. I am an activist. When I make a film, I'm also an activist for cinema. And politics are at the root of the film. And you turn them into art. But then there's politics in the end also, in the way people look at the film. And I find that quite beautiful, I must say. And I'm totally aware that I'm bringing out on the screen new imaginaries, a new power dynamic. I am also totally aware that this is a great opportunity for art, fiction, a great opportunity for audience to have new emotional rides, new perspective on cinema. And also, I hope, for writers and directors feeling legitimate to tell their stories.
Because the question of both who gets to tell stories in art and what are those stories that are being depicted, mm-hmm. and then as well, what are all the stories that we have not seen mm-hmm. as audiences because of who's making those decisions? These, again, are things that are explicitly dealt with in the movie. Mm-hmm. And is it exciting for you to have the movie engaging with those issues in particular?
It is very exciting, and it is very exciting to see that people are excited by the ideas. I think, you know, cinema is about having desire for ideas, and the fact that those ideas can create new desires, I think, is a very beautiful dynamic. And I'm not afraid of being labeled. You know, sometimes I'm being told, oh, but don't you find it narrowing for you, for your work, that people would say it's a feminist film or would say it's a lesbian film? And my answer is that, I mean, well, it's narrowing if you think those imaginaries aren't powerful. And I think they are wide. I think they are strong opportunities for art. I think they are also strong political statements. I think ideas that have seduction and that are often despised, I think it's ideas that have a program that is dangerous. So I don't see it as something that would reduce my work or its consequences. We should totally be proud.
And now you are one of the founders of 50/50 by 2020, which mm-hmm. is a group working towards gender parity in the film industry. Is there a connection for you between that work that you do within the industry itself mm-hmm. and the work that you are presenting on screen?
Well, those things connect because I learn a lot from those struggles. Also, I'm very privileged within this industry. So connecting also with other directors, and being in a collective, experimenting, being political and being on the field makes you grow, makes you more aware, makes you more connected to new ideas. So I see it as something very nourishing for our work. And it's also influenced by the cultural moment we're living. And as I'm passionate about that moment, I mean, I read a lot. It's an intellectual process that makes you better, I think. Because once more, cinema is about ideas. It's about ideas. So the more you get connected to new ideas, contemporary ideas, political awareness, new desires, the more also you have empathy. I mean, being a director for me is all about loving the present. Yeah, it's about loving the contemporary. So the more I connect to those kind of energies and ideas and collective, the more inspired I am.
Celine Sciamma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Paige Heimsen, and our audio engineer, Mike Heffler. Subscribe to The Real on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review. You can also visit us at latimes.com/The Real.